you want to explore unique perspectives that are rarely expressed in mainstream media, you are listening to the right channel. This is CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, BC.
New Dimensions is brought to you by Friends of New Dimensions membership support and by Larson Publications, publisher of the book An Open Life, Joseph Campbell in conversation with Michael Toms. New Dimensions and our quarter-hour New Dimensions Cafe programs are now available worldwide as podcasts. You can find them at the iTunes Store and on many podcast sites and mobile apps. You can also find our podcasts and much more on our website, newdimensions.org. It is only through a change in human consciousness that the world will be transformed. The personal and the planetary are connected. As we expand our awareness of mind, body, psyche, and spirit, and bring that awareness actively into the world, so also will the world be changed. This is our quest as we explore new dimensions.
New Dimensions listeners have proven themselves to be part of the tribe of change makers. We're active participants in helping to create a better world. And this brings up a question that begs answers, which is, how do we keep ourselves in the game, so to speak, when we become overwhelmed, dispirited, and downhearted by the enormity of the needs in today's challenging times? I found some help for us through a sustainable form of activism described as microactivism. Our guest today believes that the size of the action isn't the point. What matters is that we take regular action. These can be done in a small amount of time and don't take a huge amount of energy, yet they have a cumulative effect that is disproportionate to the individual effort they require. Together, these millions of incremental steps lead to a tipping point. Indeed, over and over, history has shown this to be true. And this is what we'll be exploring today with our guest, Omkari L. Williams. Omkari L. Williams has devoted her life to change-making. She leads activism workshops and trainings and is a host of the podcast Stepping Into Truth, where she interviews activists from all walks of life. Omkari L. Williams is the author of Microactivism: How You Can Make a Difference in the World Without a Bullhorn. Small actions equal big results. Join us for the next hour as we explore how you too can make a difference through the practice of microactivism with our guest, Omkari L. Williams. I'm speaking with Omkari from her home by remote connection. I'm Justine Willis-Toms. I'll be your host. Welcome to New Dimensions. Omkari, welcome.
Oh, hi, Justine. Thank you so much for having me on.
It's my pleasure. I would love for you to introduce yourself a bit to our listeners and to give us a brief view of how you became a change maker and became an activist.
Sure. Well, for me, it really started because my father was a diplomat and a humanitarian. And he started his work resettling refugees from Vietnam in the United States, and then branched out to doing work that took him to places as diverse as Malaysia and the former Yugoslavia and Rwanda during the genocide. So I really grew up in an environment where I understood how much privilege I had, even as a young Black girl in the United States. I wasn't living in a war zone. I had food on the table. I had an education. And that made me understand how important it was to do something to redress the balance. You know, we're so out of balance in the world. So I remember my first real activist steps was going out trick-or-treating for UNICEF. And I was so proud of myself. And my friend Nicole and I went out together, and she was 7 and I was 8, you know, so I was the big kid, right?
What did you dress as?
You know, it's funny. I don't remember what I was. I remember that she was a pumpkin. Her mom had made her a pumpkin costume, and I remember it so vividly, mostly because someone squirted water on her and her paint started to run and she started to cry. And I remember thinking, you're a grown up. You're not supposed to do that. When we say trick or treat, we don't really mean trick. But that was the beginning of my activism, was just to try and raise money to help children who needed it. Gone on from there.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. You have a whole history now that's strung together. When you talk about microactivism, we think about, how can these micro things make a difference? How can they actually be effective?
You know, I think that that's something that when we engage with that question, if we go deeply enough, the answer actually becomes kind of apparent from our own experience in life. I mean, if you think about the things that have happened in your life and how there are some things that were really small, seemingly small, but they impacted you dramatically. Someone's kindness, someone's small kindness, or someone's small, seemingly small unkindness that you still remember to this day. And microactivism is kind of like that, in that it's not about the specific size of the action. It's about the impact. And we don't always see the impact. We can do something like go to the food pantry and volunteer there. And we can see that, yes, we're handing out food to a family in need, but we don't necessarily see what that meal means for that family in the larger scope. It might mean that a kid actually gets to learn when they're in school because they're not hungry. Yes. It might mean that a mother doesn't have to take on a third job in order to feed her family. So she actually gets to spend some time at home with her kids. And we can see part of the impact, but like most things in life, there's a depth and a ripple effect that we're never going to see, but we know from our own experience that it's real.
When you talk about that, we don't know the names of those people who are working at the food pantry, so to speak, and it reminds me of something that you write about and remind us in your book. When the civil rights legislation was passed, it actually took many, many months. And you remind us of all the unsung, unknown people that gathered together after that bus boycott, and people were having to walk to work.
Yeah.
And you say something about that collective gathering.
Yeah, the bus boycott really always struck me because it's hot in the Deep South. It's hot in Alabama, right? And people walk to work for a year, which means they walk to work in the rain. They walk to work in storms, and the South can get hit with some big storms. We all know this. They walk to work in sweltering heat, and then had to go to work and work in a time when it wasn't air conditioned. So they added sometimes hours onto their day. But they grouped together, and they, as much as possible, created ride shares for people. So someone would be the shuttle driver that day and pick up as many people as they could squeeze in their car. But they kept each other going because they together knew that they had power that they did not have as individuals. And they eventually forced the desegregation of the buses. And that was an enormous accomplishment. But it wouldn't have happened without all of those people who said, I'm going to make the sacrifice for as long as it takes of walking to work if that's how I get there, or some other thing that's less convenient than the bus, because there's a goal in my heart that is more important than my immediate comfort.
That reminds me of the advice that you give to keep our focus narrow. You use something like the Noah's Ark concept of keeping our focus narrow. So share that, because you mentioned this throughout the book.
Yeah, I call it my Noah's Ark rule. And it's, you know, I actually didn't grow up in a family that was a church-going family, but I knew the Noah's Ark story, right? And, you know, only two of it, each species of animal on the ark. And when I was thinking about how to best do our activism, I thought, you know, we really need to focus. We can't spread ourselves too thin. There are so many causes pulling at our attention. But there are also, you know, about 8 billion people on the planet. So if we all would focus on the one or at most two things that we really care about, we would get a lot done, because there are 8 billion of us. And between all of us, we've got it all covered. But it also means that we're not burning ourselves out by trying to do a whole bunch of things in the limited amount of time we have, with the limited amount of energy that we have. So if you choose your one or your two things that you really are passionate about, that helps. It helps keep you going when things are hard, because you say to yourself, okay, it's just this thing and I really care about this, I'm going to do it. As opposed to a lot of things that you sort of care about, but aren't really passionate about. And you don't need to be passionate about everything. I'm not.
Well, you know, when you say that, you have a process that I did in the book about going to your origin story. Once you have a focus, you suggest that you might go to a story that you have in your past that actually informs why you're focusing on that right now. And I did that process and I was blown away. And what I learned is, oh, I really have passion about this. I've had passion about this all my life.
Yes.
So is that why you do that origin story process?
Yeah, it is really. I mean, I think of your origin story as basically the impetus that drives your activism. For me, you know, it was my family's experience of my dad's work and understanding how lucky I was in the world and how that kind of luck is actually really a rarity. Most people in the world struggle. And so for me, that understanding was my origin story. I was able to say, okay, my life is distinctly different than other people's just by accident of birth. And that doesn't seem fair to me. And so how can I make it right? For someone else, the origin story might have to do with being bullied as a child or witnessing someone being bullied and saying to yourself, when I'm bigger, I'm going to make sure that this is not what is happening, because this is wrong. So I think of it that way. It's like, go back to the thing that got you on the path to begin with, and then move forward from there.
Wonderful, wonderful. I'm here with Onkari Williams, and she is the author of Microactivism, How You Can Make a Difference in the World Without a Bullhorn. Small actions equal big results. If you want to know more about Onkari Williams, you can go to her website, onkariwilliams.com, and she spells Onkari, O-M-K-A-R-I, onkariwilliams.com, or you can get there through the New Dimensions website, newdimensions.org. I'm Justine Willis-Toms. You're listening to New Dimensions.
Stem, toi coucou, toi coucou, stem, 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 toi coucou, toi coucou. Stem, toi coucou, toi coucou, stem, 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 toi coucou, toi coucou.
Stem, toi coucou, toi coucou, stem, 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 toi
tu dis, toi coco, tu te dis, tu dis, toi coco, tu dis, toi coco, tu te dis, 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 tu dis, toi.
I'm here with Omkari Williams, and we're talking about microactivism. One of the things you said to start us off with it, we don't have to focus on the how. You know, in fact, that might discourage us from starting to be active. So talk about what might we focus on then?
Yeah, I think the place to start is not with the how, because if you start thinking about how, your brain is probably going to explode because there are so many things that come up as soon as you think about how. And I think that for most of us, when we start thinking about how, what happens is we think about all the reasons we can't. So instead of thinking about all the reasons we can't, I really think that we should focus on the thing we want to do, and then just say, okay, what is the smallest thing I can do to move myself in this direction rather than the larger how? Am I going to make this goal happen? Just the tiniest step. So for instance, if your goal is to be part of ending world hunger, I mean, if it was easy, it would have happened already. So you can't do that, but you could feed one person one meal. You could offer an unhoused person that you see on the street a gift card for your local food co-op. You could take some leftover vegetables from your garden to the food pantry where they get turned into a meal. You could do any number of tiny little things like that that really do matter. I mean, yes, you're not ending world hunger, but it certainly matters to the person you're feeding that they are getting fed. And so I think scaling it down.
This past week, I was telling one of my circles about this upcoming interview with you, Omkari, and one of the members of that group, Rosemary Williams, she's just come through a terrible accident where she broke two bones in her pelvis, and she's been like in a wheelchair for a year in extreme pain, but she's on the other side of that now. And what she's doing, she said, oh, well, I've been cooking chicken soup for my neighbors, and I will invite them in for chicken soup, and I'll give them an amaryllis flower. And so it was just so delightful to see her participating with a loving gift of soup. And it seems like a small thing, but it's not a small thing.
It's not a small thing. It's not only not a small thing for the food, it's not a small thing because she's also building community. And that is so important. We are starved for connection in this society. And so, you know, as you were telling the story, Justine, I was thinking about how lovely it is to also have an amaryllis plant in your home and how beautiful they are and to have color in the winter and all of the different ripples, once again, of this simple action of creating a pot of soup and giving away some plants really does have an impact beyond just the feeding of someone. Because you're not only feeding their body, you're feeding their soul.
Oh, for sure, for sure. And we've been talking about not doing this in isolation and community. It's really kind of a theme that's coming up. if once we found our focus, Omkari, what are some of the things we can do to find a community of people who are interested in working in the same focus?
Yeah, I mean, here's where I think the internet is such a useful tool, because you can literally go online and do a search for people interested in raising chickens in my area. And you will get probably more answers in 5 seconds than you can even handle. And you can do that with anything, right? You can just put that in and, you know, in, put in your zip code or whatever. And it'll show up with a whole bunch of opportunities for you. And then you get to choose and you get to find your way in. And I think something that's important is to allow ourselves time to find our way into something, to not sort of prejudge and feel like if it's not a perfect fit right away, because really what new thing generally is, you know, that first day of school kind of feeling, you're sort of looking around thinking, oh, I hope some of these people become my friends. And then 3 months later, that's your friend circle. You know, you have found yourself at home, even though you didn't feel that way the first day. So I think giving ourselves some time and allowing ourselves to just explore what's out there. But definitely, I say internet search, but also talk to your friends. You never know what people are interested in. You never know what obscure thing you find fascinating that another friend finds fascinating as well, unless you say, is anyone interested in X, Y, or Z? And someone raises their hand and you're thinking, oh my goodness, I had no idea, right?
Right.
So talking about things, asking questions, doing an internet search, go to your local library, talk to the librarian. Librarians are amazing. Unbelievable resources. Just start small and work your way out.
Do you tell a story about when you moved from New York to Savannah, Georgia, I believe?
And, yes.
And you had this conversation with this woman, just like incidental contact, and it led to something, didn't it?
Yeah. I had moved to Savannah, and I knew, and I'm not exaggerating, I knew no one. Not a soul. I had been there many years before, and I had thought, oh, I'd like to live here at some point. So I did. And I had been there maybe 3 days, and I thought, you know, I just drove from New York. It's time for me to get the oil in my car changed. And I'm at the service station, and there's this young woman sitting there getting the car, oil in her car changed, and we start chatting, and I told her that I was new in town, and she said, oh, well, there's this organization that meets every Tuesday, and it's a whole bunch of entrepreneurs and people interested in social justice. You should come. And I thought, yeah, sure, why not? And I went, and I loved it. And I kept going week after week and met so many people who are still friends to this day because of that conversation. And also because I'd made a promise to myself that I was going to say yes to everything for a year, unless it was skydiving or bungee jumping. Those I could say no to.
Right. You know, that reminds me of a quote that someone we interviewed several decades ago, Doug Boyd, and he is the author of Rolling Thunder. And he said, I want to quote this. He said, the most powerful mantra you can say are these two words, I'm available. And then he went on to say, then you've got to watch out, because if you really mean it, things happen.
And I agree.
That's what happened for you. You said, okay, I'm going to show up. And you did a constancy in your showing up. And
yes,
that's another part that you really are saying to us, like, don't give up too soon.
Don't give up too soon. You know, the first time I went to that that group meeting, I didn't know anyone. And the person who had told me about it wasn't able to be there that week. So I was all by myself, and, you know, it was a little awkward, and I felt like, oh gosh, you know, I'm the only person here who knows no one. But they were very nice people. And I went back the next week, and then I didn't have no relationship. I had a small relationship with these people. And then it built from there. So I think when you say I'm available, yeah, I think it's true. I think that all of a sudden opportunities present themselves. And I think saying yes is a really powerful thing when you do it with intention.
But you also talk about radical realism. And that's another, yes. You know, saying yes, that's good. But you caution us in certain ways. So what are the cautions you give us?
So the caution is that we are one person with a limited amount of energy, a limited amount of time, and typically a lot of responsibilities. So radical realism is the idea that you actually live in the life you're living. You're not pretending that you're living some life that allows you to say yes to all of these things when that's not the case. I mean, if you are the parent of small children, you have probably considerably less free time than if you're a retiree and responsible only for yourself. So radical realism is really about looking at where you are in life, what your responsibilities are, what your commitments are, and deciding from there, what can you realistically add on to your plate in terms of your activist work? Not your fantasy of what you'd like it to look like, but the reality of what's possible for you at this moment, knowing that it's going to change, because that's the constant in life is change.
And then in making that commitment, and you look at your life and you say, okay, I can spare a half an hour a day or a half an hour three times a week to this focus. And then it's a matter of making, I think you talk about making a plan, and really that helps you stick to it. So you're not making a decision every time, every day, every time you say, oh, here it's Wednesday and I need to, you're not having to decide to do it because you've laid out a plan.
And yeah, I would even say half an hour a week, not even three times a week. Half an hour a week. And on, let's stick with the food pantry. Saturday morning, I'm going to the food pantry from 9 to 9:30 every Saturday. It's not a conversation. I don't have to think about it. I know that on Saturday at 9 o'clock, I'm going to be at the food pantry. That's where I'm going to be. And then we take decision fatigue out of the mix, because every time we throw in having to make a decision, that takes so much energy. It's decision-making is hard, which is why often we default to sitting on the couch.
Right. Exactly. I just want to make a comment about that. To focus on that particular time will save us from overwhelm, because we're making a commitment within our life energy, what we have to give. And so it's easier, and it helps us to stay out of overwhelm. So that's part of being effective. I'm here with Omkari Williams, and she's the author of Microactivism: How You Can Make a Difference in the World Without a Bullhorn. Small actions equal big results. I'm Justine Willis-Toms. You're listening to New Dimensions.
New Dimensions is brought to you by Friends of New Dimensions membership support and by Larson Publications, publisher of the book An Open Life, Joseph Campbell in Conversation with Michael Toms. New Dimensions and our quarter-hour New Dimensions Cafe programs are now available worldwide as podcasts.